Support for WYPR comes from University of Maryland Medical System, where world-class doctors are pioneering immunotherapy that's helping to stop cancer in its tracks. And with screenings and advanced treatments across the state, it's cancer care made for Marylanders. Learn more at umms.org/cancer.
There I am having cocktails at like 18 years old in Washington, D.C., and having like the time of my life.
This world leader was born in Kiev, then became a United States citizen before becoming, in 1969, the prime minister of a country founded in the 20th century.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Henkin.
And I'm Laura Wexler.
And this week on the podcast, That's my Alex Trebek, in case you're wondering.
Or just like random Canadian.
Two stories about coming up short on a big stage.
So this first storyteller is Brendan Dorr, who is sort of a local bartender celebrity in Baltimore. And he's sharing a tale about a time he put his drink-making skills to the test.
So there I was in New Zealand, standing in front of about 150 people, getting ready for us to perform in the final event of the Cocktail World Cup. I'm standing there in a U.S. Olympic sprinter singlet, and I'm singing opera. So how did I get there? In 1997, I was going into college, and I decided, all right, I can't work at the mall anymore. I should probably go work in like a restaurant because that seems like better for college hours and hopefully I'll make a little better money. And so I go and get a job. I get a job at a place down in Potomac, Maryland called Hunter's Inn. It's kind of like a tavern meets like a kind of fine dining restaurant. I went in, tried to get a job. They were like, no way. But I convinced them because I guess I was charming enough or eager enough. And very quickly, I took to it like a fish in water. I became friends with a lot of the servers and who were much older than me, 25, 35 years old. And they would take me down into D.C. to go to bars. And I'm only like 18 years old at this time. I don't have a fake ID. And I'm like, well, I can't get in there. And they're like, oh, come on. We know everybody. So we just go in. There I am having cocktails at like 18 years old in Washington, D.C. and having like the time of my life at the bar. Late at night, we'd hang out. I'd have cigars that like a patron would bring back from Jamaica. And they're like, oh, they're Cubans. It's awesome. And I'm like drinking Goose Island IPA. I was hooked. It was so much fun to be in the restaurant industry. I'm still in college and I'm studying architecture. But a couple years passed and I was like, all right, architecture isn't for me. But I can sing and I've always been singing. So I apply to Peabody here in Baltimore and I get into Peabody. I moved to Baltimore in 1999, and I continue to work in restaurants. I work at the Owl Bar, I work at the Black Olive, at Ixia. At college ends, I finish college, and I decide, all right, I'm going to keep working in restaurants for a little. That was a bit of college. Let's see what working in restaurants is like for a bit longer. I eventually become the bar manager at Ixia. And eventually move on to being like the beverage director, which is like I know something about wine, I know something about cocktails, I'm feeling very important. And I kind of get a little bit of notoriety and kind of go out and see some things. And at that time at Ixia, we're serving martinis. Everything was martinis. If it was mango and vodka, apple martini, espresso martini. But I was like, all right, there are other people making like cocktails, not martinis. Not everything in a cocktail glass is a martini. So I was like, all right, we can do something a little more cocktail-like. So we slowly transformed the martini list into a cocktail menu. And then one day a friend of mine goes, hey, you know, there's this cocktail competition called the Cocktail World Cup. You should enter it. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. So I enter the competition. The big night arrives, and I have to go compete. It's down in the Inner Harbor on the Constellation. I make my signature drink called the Queen Bee. If you've ever had a bee's knees, it is like a bee's knees. In this case, though, vodka, a little bit of yuzu, honey, elderflower. And, you know, I'm there. I show up, and there's this guy in a red, it almost looks like he's wearing like a Masters like jacket, like a golf jacket. And I'm like, okay, where am I? What is this? I watched some of the other competitors compete, and I'm like, all right, they're doing all right, but I think I can do better. So it's my turn to compete. I compete. I'm shaking my cocktails, performing really great, pour out the cocktail. It looks perfect. I have the right glasses. I even brought my own glassware. And I finish. Mr. Red Jacket goes, now that's how you make a drink. And he tastes it, and he goes, oh, that's delicious. And I win the competition. So I won the regional finals, and I'm getting to go to New Zealand. But I really didn't know still what this competition was about. So I first have to go to New York, and I find out that the competition really isn't just a single like a single solo act. You have teammates. So my teammates are Sammy from New York and Bobby from Boston. And Sammy from New York, by the way, is a very famous bartender named Sam Ross. You probably had one or two of his very famous cocktails, a penicillin or a paper plane. He is probably one of the most famous bartenders globally. And I'm like, awesome, this is great. I got like a really good expert on the team. So we meet up in New York. They fly us to LA, where we meet the other like six US competitors. Then they fly us to Auckland. We get to Auckland, and there are 30 other competitors from around the world. We get on a plane, pretty small plane. There's like 30, 40 bartenders on the small plane. We're flying to Queenstown, to the South Island. And it was like something out of being like in a rock band. You have all these people who are super excited. The adrenaline's high, high-fiving. We're flying into Queenstown between two mountains. It's snowing, and it feels like maybe the plane is going to come down. It does not. We survived. We land. We get off the flight, and on the tarmac, they have a 42 below vodka bus waiting for us. You're like, okay, this is awesome. Get on the bus, put your bags in this van. We're going to the first competition, like right off the plane. The first competition was we had to bungee jump off of the A.J. Hackett Bridge. And after you bungee jumped, you had to climb back up this big, steep hill. I mean, it was really steep. And then you had to what is called free pour, where you have to just kind of pour without measuring into a jigger. You had to free pour three different amounts and blindly, so you couldn't see how much you were pouring, and you had to be very accurate. So imagine bungee jumping. Your adrenaline is like pumping, much like mine is right now. And then when you get to the top of the hill, you're just sucking wind. And so free pouring is kind of hard at that moment. I go, everybody else goes. Next day, we're like jet boating and making punches. This competition was true like Kiwi, Australia, like extreme sports and bartending. After a few days, we get to the end of all the preliminary competitions or the events, and they say, all right, we're going to tell you who is going into the final event. They sit everybody down. We're in much like you are tonight, and they go through all the bar teams that have made the finals. And I'm sitting there next to Sam, and we're listening, and we're not hearing our name. We're feeling pretty confident that like we had done well. And they get to the end, and then they say, and we haven't been named, they say, so we have one more bar team that is the best bar team. They have shown exemplary barmanship skills. It was us. Right on. We came in first at that moment. Fantastic. We're feeling really proud of ourselves. So we have one more event, which is the finals. The final cocktail has to be something that is inspirational about our visit to New Zealand. So Sam and I had discussed about doing punches, because punches were really in vogue at that time. And we decided we're going to like take kind of like our surrounding area. We're in like ski chalets in the mountains. So we're like, all right, we're going to like get some, Sam's going to forage for some stuff. I'm going to go into town and get some more like basic ingredients. So I head into town, Sam heads out to forage. Bobby, by the way, was like a club bartender and not really into all this. We just kind of directed him on what to do, and he nailed it, but I think he took a nap. Sam goes off, I go to town. I come back, and I find out from one of my teammates that Sam took one of the kitchen knives with him. to go saw down some tree limbs and get some evergreen boughs and cut his hand really bad. He had to go to the hospital. He had to get stitches. I'm back at our little chalet. Sam shows up. His hand is all wrapped up like a mummy. And I'm thinking, great, how are we going to compete in this competition? And so we sit down once the drugs wore off of Sam for a bit. We come up with a game plan. We tell Bobby exactly what he's going to do. And Sam goes, you know, I got one more thing that I think will really help us stand out from everybody else. And he comes back from his suitcase and he has these U.S. Olympic singlets for us to wear. And when I say singlet, I mean it's like a wrestler's outfit or it only comes to your thighs and it's very skin tight and very revealing. So we're putting on our singlets the next day for the competition. We're ready to go. And we're looking at each other and we're all right, these don't leave anything for the imagination. So Sam's I'm getting a sock. Puts a sock in his crotch. Bobby's I'm getting two socks. I used a sock. But yeah, so we go to the competition. We have robes on. We don't want to reveal our big reveal. And everybody goes, and we were the last to go because we chose to be last. And we get up on stage and we take off the robes and everybody's hooting and hollering and loving it. And so there I am in New Zealand, standing on a stage in front of 150 people about to perform in the Cocktail World Cup wearing a U.S. Olympic singlet singing opera. And that was probably the day that solidified me into working in bars for my life.
You know, Brendan is the owner of Dutch Courage and the Flamingo.
Mm-hmm. I do know that. And like I said, legendary for making great drinks around here. I wonder what the Australians thought of the singlets.
Or the New Zealands.
Oops. Sorry about that. They're kind of similar, aren't
we're
they?
We're going to call them New Zealands and take
well,
out
Well, I mean, you did a Canadian,
great Canadian accent.
We're revealing a lot of international knowledge here. We're going to take a quick break before our next story. This story is from Josh Frulinger, and this is from really early in the Stoop, first couple of years.
Yeah, 2009, I think, 2008, actually, 2008. Yeah. This is when Alex Trebek was still with us, RIP.
Yeah. Yeah, and apparently when Jeopardy was still hard, according to my mother-in-law, it's just not that hard anymore, and the people don't know anything.
Oh, gee.
Take a listen.
All right, this is your final Jeopardy question, which was my final Jeopardy clue. This world leader was born in Kiev, then became a United States citizen before becoming, in 1969, the prime minister of a country founded in the 20th century. So hold that in your head for a minute. So I was not born in Kiev. I was born in Buffalo. Buffalo, you know us, we don't live there now. And so I grew up fairly quickly into not an ordinary child. When other ordinary children were outside playing sports or enjoying fresh air or interacting with other children, I was inside. I liked to read books. I like to trace maps with tracing paper out of atlases obsessively. I like to read encyclopedias that my parents bought me, and I would get very upset when I found out that the encyclopedias were 30 years old and a lot of the information was outdated. So I was exactly the kind of child who, at the age of about 8 or so, would be very, very excited to learn that a new trivia show was coming on the air. And, you know, there was this whole blitz about this new Jeopardy, which apparently there used to be an old Jeopardy before my time. So this new show was coming on, and I watched it really obsessively. My mom and I watched Jeopardy every night, back when Alex Trebek had a mustache still. And even though I was a little kid and, you know, growing older, but still a kid, I knew a lot of the answers on Jeopardy because of my nerdiness. And people started to say, you should be on Jeopardy. And I said, yes, I should be on Jeopardy. So I filled out the 3x5 card to be on the kids tournament and then to be on the teen tournament and then to be on the college tournament. Nothing ever came of it. So A few years ago, my wife, who is generally responsible for anything I do that involves initiative on my part, said to me, you know, you should really find out about trying out to be on Jeopardy. And after about the 10th time she said this, I'm like, all right, fine. So it's all on the, you can try out on the internets now. So you go, so the first step is you have to take a test online that proves whether you actually have the trivia knowledge. And apparently I did, because I took it online and I got invited to the next stage, which is an in-person tryout. They do mock games. The purpose of this stage is to find out whether you can make eye contact with your fellow human beings or whether you're kind of a borderline Asperger's case. So I went down there and I felt like I did okay. They put you through some mock games. They make you prep for that insanely awkward conversation with Alex where you talk about your hobbies. And so then they're like, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. So about a year later, they do call me, and they said, come to Los Angeles in 4 weeks, you're on Jeopardy. So it's very exciting. So my wife and I get on the plane, fly out, stay in the nice hotel, go to the big studio. So you go there. First of all, they film 5 shows a day, and you go in a big pool of contestants. You go there over 2 days, and so it's kind of like if you have a season pass to Jeopardy on your TiVo, and you just watch it right in a row. It's very intense. That song haunts you for days. And so all the contestants, you hang out with the other contestants, people work on the show, they're incredibly nice. All the contestants, incredibly nice, except for this one woman. And so I sit through a whole day of shows watching from the audience. I don't get picked. Next day I go back. The third show of the day, I get picked. It's me. It's the woman I can't stand. And it's Mark, the guy who's just won 3 shows in a row and is really good. And if people watch Jeopardy, he won a lot. So he was really good. So the thing about Jeopardy is you watch the show at home and sometimes you see a guy on the show or a woman on the show and they're just not answering. You're like, who's this idiot? How'd they get on the show? The thing is, they're very smart, let me tell you. But... The hardest part about Jeopardy, and the one thing that you cannot practice at home, is the buzzer. You have to buzz in at exactly the right time. You can't buzz in while Alex is still reading the clue. Even though the clue is right there, you can read it. And, of course, you read it to the end, and you already know the answer. But you can't buzz in until Alex is done, or you get blocked out for just long enough, usually for someone else to jump in. So I'm up there on the stage. I'm next to the woman I can't stand. But she's not getting to me because I can't help but focus on how terribly I'm doing. First 5 minutes of the show is nothing, and I'm just eating it. I'm up there, I'm pressing the button, I'm that guy who's like, and nothing is happening. Mark is like, yes, and so finally, about halfway before the first commercial break, I get my first right answer. And it did kind of feel like I broke through a wall a little bit. The rest of the show, I get ahead of the woman between us. We get to the very end of the show, the final Jeopardy clue. I'm in second place. I'm way, way behind. But if I get it right and Mark gets it wrong, then I will win. So then the final Jeopardy clue comes up. It's world leaders, which is one of my dorkiest dorky things I love to dork out about. I'm like, I'm totally going to get this. So that clue comes up, and it's in blank, total blank. So, does anyone here know who it is? You can just shout it out. It was, in fact, Gold in My Ear. My Jewish grandmother spinning in her grave. Fortunately, Mark got it right, which meant that even if I had gotten it right, I still wouldn't have won. I came up with a very obscure Eastern Europe Czechoslovakian leader from the 60s that I write down at the last minute because I want to write down something. Unlike the woman next to me who wrote a bunch of question marks, I'm still kind of smug about that. So it's done. And I should say, you know, a lot of people on the stage tonight have talked about how competitive they are. And I am not a competitive person at all, which is one of the reasons why I was sort of hesitant to do Jeopardy in the first place. And I didn't realize until the moment I lost how much I really wanted to win. Because there are a couple of reasons. One is that everyone, you know, I'm a big dork, and it's like huge dork cred. And, you know, my whole life I wanted to be on this show, and I was on it for 20 minutes, and then it was over. And I also could have won a lot of money, which is not something to be, you know, sneezed at. So anyway, I felt really shitty afterwards. And, you know, I went, one of my best friends was in town, also went to see it, and we went out to lunch, and I felt really crappy with my wife and my friend. And we're like, But, so I started, I felt a little better afterwards. You do get $1,000 just for being in first place, which is, you know, not what Mark got, but it it was something. So I come home, and now this is one thing about being on game shows in general, is that there's about a 3-month window between when you film it and when it comes on TV. And you're allowed to tell your, you know, your close, your inner circle is allowed to know, but they really don't want you spreading the information around. So most people didn't know how I had done. In that 3-month window, we bought a new car because our old one died, and we went to Italy because we had been saving up for 2 years to do it. But these purchases raised certain expectations, which started to make me sort of anxious all over again. And so very quickly, we realized that the number of people who wanted to watch the show with us was going to be larger than the amount of people we could fit in our house. So we went up to a bar near where we live, PJ's, on Charles Street, and asked if we could have a Jeopardy party there. And they said yes. They were all big Jeopardy nerds. So the day comes, it's my show, and I'm sort of anxious all over again for, you know, that I've already let myself down and my inner circle down, and now I'm going to let this whole new set of people down with my failure. So we get there, and, you know, there's about, and people are coming in, people I don't know are there, just happen to be in the bar, and the show comes on, and they turn it on, and every TV, there's like 4 big screen TVs all over the bar, all my heavily made up face. In high def. So I'm watching the show, and I thought that first 5 minutes on the show was bad when I was doing it, it was even worse watching it live on screen, because I'm listening to everyone else, sort of like just not making any noise at all watching this. And then I finally get that first right answer, and everybody cheers. And I was sort of taken aback. It was not what I was expecting. And I sort of realized as the game goes on, and they're all cheering for me, and they're booing Mark, and they're booing this other woman. And I realized that I'd never really been on any kind of competitive athletics when I was a kid, what with the encyclopedia reading. And I had been on Little League, but, like, you know, at a level where the only people who come are your parents, and they, you know. So I had never really had this experience that people are actually cheering for me. And in a way, it's kind of awesome because I didn't even have to be distracted by competing. Like, I could just appreciate the cheering and watch myself, you know, sort of catching up. I looked like I was doing better. So, you know, as we're getting towards the end, and I suddenly have this weird brain flash, like, maybe it's going to end differently this time. Maybe I'm going to win. And it's going to be so great. But it turned out that didn't happen. So, but, you know, it was great. It was really awesome. Everyone was there, and, you know, and then I got to stand up, and everyone cheered, and I got to tell basically a variation of this story I just told you. Apologies to anyone who was there and saw it already. And I realized, you know, like, in a way, I did win. But, you know, in another way, I lost, and it would have been nice to have the money.
I will have you know that after listening to Josh's story, I went online and took a Jeopardy quiz to see if I might one day go on Jeopardy. And you can tell Gene, it's fucking hard.
Do you remember any of the questions?
Yeah, I do. But I don't know what the answers are because they didn't give it to you. I do know one. There was one question about a... Paul Newman. Yeah, Paul Newman was in a movie about hockey in like the 1970s. Do you know this?
No.
Yeah, well, neither did I. So,
what is the answer?
I don't know, because it went so quickly. It was 50 questions, like coming at like a Tommy gun.
Yeah. Well, you know, and Josh talks about the buzzer, and actually my daughter had like a gathering the other night, and the discussion was about Jeopardy for a long time, and apparently several people had relatives who had been on the show.
Oh, my God.
And they talked about how difficult the buzzer is.
I just want to state for the record that is at once so endearing and the nerdiest high school gathering.
Yeah.
If you're spending, not only are you talking a lot about Jeopardy, but many of the people at the gathering had relatives that
were
on.
And I personally wanted the conversation to shift to crossword puzzles.
Oh.
You know, for something a little more wild. But anyway, I also love that Josh says, you know, when he's about to watch this with a group of people, like, maybe it's going to end differently time. And I just thought, God love ya. God bless ya. Anyway, despite not winning large pots of money on Jeopardy,
well, he got
Josh is doing great.
Yeah.
Yep. He is a writer and a producer in L.A. And he has a longstanding blog about comic strips. Can we get one more Alex Trebek impression before we go?
So sorry, Laura, but that's not the right request.
Damn you, Alex Trebek. All right. Well, thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the stories. If you want to learn more about the Stoop Storytelling series, you can visit us at stoopstorytelling.com or find us on social media. We want to thank Maureen Harvey for being a producer. And we will be back soon with more stories from the Stoop.